Hey, as we get started today, though, let me kind of get our mind thinking by asking kind of this question. Have you ever had that moment where you thought you knew somebody, but you had mistakenly thought they were somebody when actually that's not who they were? You ever had that moment when you mistook somebody for somebody else? Kind of that awkward moment of, hey, how you doing? Oh, sorry, I don't know you, right? I mean, it's kind of that weird deal. A few weeks ago, I was out with a friend of mine. We were going to have some lunch here in town, and we were walking up to the restaurant, he and I, and as I'm walking up, I see somebody, this lady with her young daughter, about 6, maybe 7 years old, and as we walk up, I see her, and I think I recognize this person as someone who's fairly new to our church. I've met here, come a few times that, you know, I've met in the foyer or something, and so as I'm walking up thinking, I think I know her, she looks and makes eye contact and smiles, and says, oh yeah, that's who I think it is. So I walk up like, hey, how you doing? And I look to the little girl, as I often do. You know, we love kids here at church at South Lake and love kind of pouring into their story, and I'm a kind of a big kid anyway, so, you know, I'm always kind of like, hey, how you doing? And I go to stick my hand out for this little give me five, and as I stick my hand out, about the time it gets to her, it dawns on me, this is not who I think it is. I've never met them, right? And so right about the time my hand gets to this little girl is like, picks up her hand and is kind of going like this and reaches out and taps my hand and she's pushing into her mama's side kind of like this. And about the time she taps my hand, her mom puts her hand on her shoulder, turns, and they quickly walk the other way. At what point my friend looks at me and he says, that's why you're not in charge of children's ministry. I'm like, well, that and a lot of other reasons, I guess. So anyway, so to that mom, let me make my sincerest public apology. I thought you were someone else. Although it's sad to say, I'm not exactly sure who I mistakenly thought you were either. So I just, whoever you are, both, anyway, apologize for that whole deal. So, but here's why things like that happen. Things like that happen, and they happen to all of us, because it's one thing to know something about someone, and it's something else entirely to actually know them. Right? I mean, we all know like who somebody is or who we think we know somebody is or know something about someone, but it's something very different altogether to truly know them. For example, it's one thing to have someone who is a neighbor that you really know. Right? So our next door neighbors, we've lived next to them for many years, 10, 11 years now. I don't know how long it's been. We know them. They know us. We watch their kids grow up. They watch our kids grow up. If I see them out, I'm going to know who they are. They're going to know who I am. It's very different to have a neighbor versus someone who just lives in your neighborhood, and the only reason you know them is because they're the person always driving way too fast in that white car around the block, you know, that everyone's always complaining about. And, you know, you see them on 50 in the middle of the week, like, oh, yep, there's that dude, that moron that lives in our neighborhood. They're about to run people off the road on 50, just like they do. You know, it's one thing, right, have a neighbor or just in your neighborhood. It's one thing to have some, you know, like distant relative that you've met once or twice versus someone who is a part of your family. Right? A brother, a sister, a parent, a spouse, someone that's really a part of your family. Now, granted, sometimes there's members of our family we wish were only distantly related to us, but you don't really get to kind of choose that either. But the point is, it's one thing to be acquainted with someone, something very much entirely different to truly know them. And the reason I say all that is because when we come to Easter, what typically happens around Easter is we focus everything we talk about, everything we do, everything we learn, preach, and sing about, it's all focused around this one thing. It's all focused around what Jesus did, right? It tends to completely always be focused around what Jesus did. And what I mean by that, think about what are the things that he did. He did things like, as we talked about last week, he made that triumphal entry into Jerusalem on what we recognize as Palm Sunday, the week before Easter. Or he was gathered in that upper room eating that final Passover meal with his disciples. You know, we talk about what he did. We talked about how someone betrayed Jesus and how Jesus responded to that. We talk about what he did in the garden that night after they left that Passover meal and they're in the garden and he's praying to the point that he begins to physically sweat drops of blood. Or we talk about what he did that night, you know, when his betrayer Judas comes with that entourage to arrest him and betrays Jesus and Peter grabs a sword and cuts the soldier's ear off and Jesus stops him and heals the soul. We talk about the things that he did. And of course, there's the big three things that we all know that he did, at least on Easter. He was crucified, he was buried, and he was raised. But here's the thing. When you think about what Jesus did, the only reason the things Jesus did matter is because of who Jesus is. The only reason what he did makes any difference whatsoever, the only reason they matter, what Jesus did, is because of who Jesus is. Because who he is what enabled what he did to actually matter more than what other people were doing. The fact that he was a traveling itinerant preacher walking around Judea with a crowd following him, that wasn't special. That didn't make him different. There were lots of traveling rabbis that had kind of disciples that would follow them. That's not what made what he did matter. For that matter, there were also, Jesus was not the very first one to claim that he was more than a man. He was not the first person on the earth at that time to claim some sort of divinity. There were others that had come before him making big claims of who he was, and yet they all kind of died. Just having that claim is not what made him different. In fact, in Acts chapter 5 in the New Testament, this letter, this record of the Acts of the Apostles, in the fifth chapter, there's this record of some of the Pharisees debating what to do with the followers of Jesus because they didn't like him. They wanted him dead. They wanted to get rid of these followers of the way, as they called them. And they thought the best way to do that was to get rid of their leader, Jesus. And so they have him crucified. And they thought, once we crucify and kill him, this whole gathering and following will kind of dissipate and go away. But the exact opposite had happened. It hadn't gotten less, it had gotten more. They hadn't decreased in number, they had expanded in number. And so these Pharisees are gathered around in Acts chapter 5 trying to figure out what to do about it. And one of them stands up, his name is Gamaliel, and he says, "Hey, guys, remember, this isn't the first time this has happened." And he names a couple other people. This guy rose up and he said he was something special. And then eventually he died and all of his following disappeared. And then another guy rose up and said he was something special. And when he died, they all kind of fell away. In this present case, I think the same thing's going to be true. If he's nothing special, it'll all fall away. But he says, however, if it is of God, nothing we do is going to be able to stop this deal. So just Jesus claiming to be divine or special is not what made him memorable. Even the fact that he was crucified, it's not what made what Jesus did special. What made Jesus special was what happened later on. What made what he did matter is who he is. That's what made what he did actually matter. Now, regardless of how you came into this room this morning, regardless of how you came into the room, I know that today more than just about any other day, we are all over the map in terms of why we're here. Now, there's some of you that are here, you are longtime devoted followers of Jesus, and you're here because every Easter you're going to gather somewhere and you're going to celebrate what Jesus did, because what he did is defined by who he is. That really matters to you, right? Others are here, maybe this is your very first Easter you're celebrating as a follower of Jesus, as a Christian. We got new believers. We got people who've been believers a long time. We got some people. You might be here just in case. I mean, just in case, right? You get to the end and you're there and God's there and it's actually real. You're like, oh, wow, this was real. Hey, but remember, Easter 2019, man, you were taking roll, right? Because I was there. Maybe that's why you're here. Or maybe you're just here because, you know, that crazy fanatical religious cousin of yours, that's where you're going today for lunch. And they brought you and said, you're going to eat, you're coming to church. And so you're like, all right, that's a decent trade-off. So I know we're kind of all over the map in terms of where we are and what we believe. But regardless of where we are, I really think that most of us, if not all of us in this room, at least know something about Jesus. There's something about him that we know. The most basic being, especially on this day, that the central claim of Christianity is that Jesus died, buried, and was raised. We know that about Jesus. But what you'll find when you read about the life and ministry and story of Jesus over and over and over again is that Jesus really was not all that interested in people just being acquainted with what he did. I mean, just focused in on what he did, that wasn't really what he was most obsessed about. He wasn't even most concerned with people knowing that he's the one that did those things. What he was most concerned throughout all of his ministry was people knowing who he is, because who he is what made what he did different. It's what made it possible. And what you'll find as we go through, as we talk about these things we're going to talk about today, is that not only was Jesus interested for his followers back then 2,000 years ago to know who he is, he wants us today to be clear on who he is. Because our confidence in what Jesus accomplished for us is intimately tied with who we understand him to be. And the more we understand who he is, the more confidence we have in what he accomplished for us. I think that's what we're going to find today. So here's what we're going to do this year. We're going to look at a statement today that Jesus made about himself, something that Jesus said about who he is. And we're going to continue this not only today, but for the next several weeks, because there are several of these statements. There's actually seven of them that are recorded in the Gospel of John, things that Jesus said about himself. This is who I am. And we're going to look at several of these over the next few weeks. Today, we're going to start with one. It's not actually the very first one that he said, but it's one that has tremendous implication for this day on Easter Sunday, on Resurrection Sunday. And here's what he said about himself. He says, "I am the resurrection and the life. I am the resurrection and the life. Now, it's important what he does not say. He does not say that in a few days, because this is just about a little over a week before he's crucified when he says this. What he did not say here is that I am going to pull off a resurrection and come back to life. What he says is that I am the resurrection and life. There's something about who I am that is fundamental to what's about to happen. And the only reason what's about to happen is going to happen is because of who I am. I am the resurrection and the life. Now, I'm going to go ahead and tell you what I hope to accomplish today and what my hope by the end of our time together this morning you'll be able to see, and it's this, that when Jesus said, I'm the resurrection and the life, here's what he's trying to convince this person that he's speaking to is true. What he's trying to convince her of, her name is Martha, we'll see in just a minute, is that Jesus, when he says this, is that he's going to redeem your past by bringing your future hope into your present life. This is what he's talking about. That he will redeem your past by reaching into the future and the hope you have for the future and pulling that into your present here now. And today, because the reality is there is something in all of our past that complicates and confuses what we know and understand to be true about Jesus in the present. It's true of all of us. There's something in the past, maybe something that happened to us. It didn't make sense then, doesn't make any more sense now. Or maybe it was something that was taken from us. I can't see how this could produce anything good whatsoever. There's something in our past, whatever that is, and it doesn't really matter what it is, but there's something in pretty much all of our past that confuses what we know about Jesus here and now and keeps us from living the life today that Jesus has designed, created, and called us to live. And I believe what we find here in this statement is that Jesus wants to redeem that. He wants to uncomplicate that. He wants to unwind and untangle and help make sense of that so that in the present, we don't just live looking at the past of all that went wrong, but we can look at the future and not just one day things will get better, but he's going to reach into the future and pull that hope into your life today. That's what we're going to, I think, see through the story we're going to look at. So if you have a Bible, I would invite you to open it with me, or if you have a Bible app, whatever it might be, grab it. John chapter 11 is where we're going to be, the Gospel of John. If you don't have a Bible, should be one under a seat nearby. You'll see the page number right here on the screen for those Bibles. If you don't own a Bible, feel free to take that with you. It's our gift to you. We're glad to give it to you. If you'd like one nicer than that, there might even be one at our Guest Connect desk out there that someone left. You can have theirs because it's been here since Christmas. So a couple of you got that. All right, so John chapter 11. Before we read this, though, let me give you the backstory of what's happening right here in John chapter 11. Jesus is very close friends with these three people that we're going to read about. And if you're familiar with church and familiar with this story, you have a background at all, you'll know this story, you'll remember this story. It's a story of Martha and Mary and their brother Lazarus. And they're very good friends with Jesus. They're not just acquaintances. They're not just people that Jesus ran into once or twice and, hey, I think we've met. These are people that know Jesus. Jesus knows them. They are very close. In fact, Mary is the one, if you're familiar with the story, whose tears, she wets Jesus' feet with her tears and then dries and cleans his feet with her hair. Which, you know, we can go ahead and just say in our day is an incredibly awkward moment in the violation of personal space. In their day, not so much. It was a sign of respect and honor and humility before someone that you really looked up to. So Jesus and his disciples, they know Mary, Martha, and Lazarus very well. But Jesus and the disciples have been in Jerusalem. And it's not going very well in Jerusalem because all the religious leaders want Jesus gone. They don't like this entourage he's bringing with them, the following that he has, it's threatening to them. And so they're trying to find a way to get rid of Jesus. And they've made these plots against him, even a plot to kill him. And he knows that. And he makes a statement that my time's not yet come. And so they actually leave the city and they go outside of the city to the countryside and they're continuing to minister to people. And so while Jesus is out in the country ministering to people, he gets word from Martha and Mary because they send a friend to Jesus, very simply that your friend Lazarus is sick, please come immediately. And when he gets word of this, it's very interesting what it says. Then when Jesus hears about Lazarus being sick and that Mary and Martha want him to come, it says that Jesus decides to wait 2 days and then go to Lazarus. Like he puts off going to his friend that's sick for 2 days. And because he puts off going when he does, Lazarus dies. Right, so think about that for just a minute. If tomorrow morning I'm sitting in my office and I get a phone call from somebody, hey, so-and-so, a member of our church, deathly sick, they're in the hospital. They've requested that you would come. Would you come and pray with the family? Would you come and pray with that person? And if my response was, you know what? Maybe in a couple of days I'll think about it. I mean, you know what's going to happen. Word of that's going to get out. Hey, don't go to that church, all right? That guy may or may not show up. He may or may not care. I mean, it sounds like an extremely insensitive thing to say and to do. Hey, Lazarus is sick. He's about to die. Yeah, I'll get to it in a couple of days. Well, Jesus actually tells us why he waits for a couple of days. In fact, look what it says in John chapter 11, verse 4. When Jesus heard it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. It's for the glory of God, so that the Son of God may be glorified through it." And right there, we learn something about who Jesus is, that if we're honest, none of us probably like to admit and like to have to experience, and that is that Jesus can bring about the most glorious good out of some of the most unexplained and unexpected pain. Jesus can turn unexpected pain and even undeserved pain into the most glorious good. And that's something about who he is, something that if we're honest, we don't like to have to walk through, we don't like to admit, and probably even struggle making sense of. Now, that's a sermon for another time. We're not going to jump into that today. I have in the past, and I'm sure I will again in the future. What I want to focus in on today is that 2 days after this happens, and he says this, he finally looks at the disciples and he says, "All right, let's go. Let's go to Bethany. Let's go see Lazarus." And they go. And verse 17 is the part that I want to dial in on today. So John 11, verse 17, it says, "Now, when Jesus came, he found that Lazarus had already been in the tomb 4 days. Now, when I'm reading through Scripture, just a little side note way that I kind of read and study and try to understand what's written. When I read through Scripture and I get to a part like this, it has a random detail like this. Like, Lazarus has been in the tomb 4 days. Why didn't it just say Lazarus was already dead? But it makes the point to say that he was in there for 4 days. I have to ask the question, why? Because everything Jesus said and did is not recorded for us. We know that. In fact, at the end of the Gospel of John, John actually says, these are some of the things Jesus said and some of the things Jesus did. If we would have written all of the things that he said and did down, I suppose there's not enough books in the world to contain everything that he said and did. So we have a collection. We have kind of a snapshot of who Jesus is. But in this snapshot and collection, it seems to the writer John important to include that Lazarus has been dead for 4 days. Why? A lot of Jewish writers of the first century seem to write about a Jewish kind of superstition that believed that the spirit of a dead person could kind of linger and hover sometimes around that person in that body for 2 or 3 days. That sometimes they might just kind of hang around, I don't know, you know, kind of waiting for something to happen, but they would kind of hang around. But by day four, that didn't happen around day four, at the most 3 days. By day four, that spirit's gone. And so by waiting till the fourth day, Lazarus is not only dead, he is dead. Okay, he's really dead, seriously dead. There ain't no kind of, he was just asleep and kind of passed out. No, he's gone. There ain't no question, all right? And then here's what it says next. Here's what happens when Jesus gets there. When he gets to Bethany, I want you to look what happens next. He gets to Bethany, which was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off as he's headed, and many of the Jews had come to Mary and Martha to console them. And when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him. So get the picture. Mary and Martha at their house in Bethany. Jesus is on his way. Many of their friends have come the 2 mile journey, which is not all that far. They've come to Bethany from Jerusalem to be at their home, to comfort them, counsel with them, just kind of hang out with them. It was very much a cultural thing to do. And they would stay for days because the mourning process as a Jew in that day went on for days. But Martha and Mary, they hear that Jesus is approaching and he's coming near the house. And here's what I really want you to see. In verse 21, it says that Martha, when she goes and she runs and she went and she finds Jesus, and when she gets to Jesus, she says, "Lord, if you had been here, this would not have happened. If you had been here, my brother would not have died. If you had been here, he would not have died." You know, the first thing out of her mouth, what does Martha do? She brings up the past. The hurt of her past that is keeping her in the present from understanding who Jesus is and what Jesus is about to do. And it is a legitimate concern. Like, "Jesus, I don't get this. All you had to do was come. All you had to do was be here. And not only did you not make it in time, I've heard you actually waited 2 days. Like, it would have been bad enough if you had left immediately and it happened on your way here, but you didn't even, like, think enough of us to leave right away. You waited a couple of days and all of this is what's happened." Now, here's the thing. We have the luxury of reading this story knowing the ending, right? Spoiler alert, Jesus is going to raise Lazarus, okay? Sorry to ruin the ending. I bet you didn't see that coming, I know, right? But that's what we have the luxury of knowing how the story ends. Mary and Martha, they don't have that luxury. They have no idea in this moment how the story is going to end. All they know is that their brother got sick. They sent word to Jesus, and he didn't show up. And I want you to think about what it must have been like for these two sisters in the first century, nursing their brother, trying to nurse him back to health, waiting for Jesus to come, who ends up being a no-show. Don't know if you've ever been around death. Unfortunately, I have quite a bit in the 20-plus years I've been a pastor. It's never pretty. It's never fun. It's always hard. It's difficult. It's emotional. It's very cold. It's very hard and painful. And so you've got Martha looking at the past, saying, Jesus, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. If you had been here, this would not have happened. And see, what I think is that for many of us in this room, there really is this thing back here, back there, somewhere in the past, that for whatever reason has so defined who we are in the present that it keeps us from seeing who Jesus really is. Some form of abuse that happened to us that was unspeakable and never should have happened. Some kind of neglect that we did not deserve but was kind of imparted upon us. Or maybe it wasn't even that. Maybe it wasn't even what someone else did to you. Maybe it was what you did to someone else, or what you did to yourself, or just some really stupid, crazy, raw mistake that you made and you've never quite been able to forgive yourself. Whatever it is, it doesn't really matter. Whatever it is back there in the past, this thing has become a real hang-up for you today in the present when it comes to the truth of who God is and who Jesus wants to be and who he is for you. And it plays itself out by us wrestling with and getting really hung up on this question. And this question plays itself out in a couple ways. The question that hangs us up is either, God, how can you love me and have let this happen to me? I mean, if you really are that great of a God, that good of a God, that kind of a God, if you really do care, love, and worry, and want, and desire what's best and good for me, how could you love me and let this happen to me? Or, if it's the other question, it could be, hey, why would God love me after what I've done? I know you say he loves everyone. I know you say that what he did on the cross paid the price of everyone. I know all that lingo, but man, I've had people tell me this straight up to my face. I believe Jesus is who you say he is. I believe he was the Son of God. I believe he died on the cross for people. I just have no clue why he would want me, because I've done this, 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 and this. For Martha, it's her brother dying that in her mind would never have taken place had Jesus been here. And then watch what she does next. Look at the next thing she says, verse 22. But even now, like, I know that if you'd been here, it wouldn't have happened. But even now I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. Like, I do believe that whatever you ask, God's going to give you. And Jesus says to her, your brother will rise again. Now, here's what I think Martha is doing right here. Because it appears when you first read it that she is making this statement of huge faith. Jesus, if you'd have been here, my brother wouldn't have died. But I know that even now, whatever you ask, God will give you. It sounds like she's making this statement of really, really big faith that she believes that Jesus really can raise her brother. And that's what he goes on to say, that your brother will rise again. I don't think that's what's happening here. You know what I think she's doing? I think she's actually giving one of those Sunday school, Christianese, church people lingo kind of an answers that we say when we really don't know what else to say, but we know we're supposed to believe it, but we don't. You know what I'm talking about? I heard one preacher recently put it this way. Christian bumper sticker theology. You know, there's bumper sticker we put on. Actually, today it'd probably be more like Christian meme theology. You know, something we're going to put on social media. You know what I'm saying? I saw this one recently. Do your best and let God do the rest. I have no idea why I said it like that, but it just sounds more cliche-ish, I guess, when you say it like that, right? But do your best, let God do the rest. A friend of mine put up the other day, when life knocks you to your knees, you're in the right position to pray. Wow, that's like, okay, I get it, right? I saw another one, true story, I saw this one the other day. Don't put a question mark where God puts a period. And I read that, and I was like, I did a double take because, like, wait a minute, let me read that again. And I read it again and I read it again. Don't put a question mark where God puts a period. And I understand what they were trying to communicate. What they were trying to communicate is, hey, sometimes God sees what you and I don't see. God has a plan, purpose, and it is at work in ways that you and I don't get. God understands more and he can do more than you and I can. I absolutely get that. But what that statement also said is, hey, don't ever question God. Don't ever question why. God doesn't want that. No, you just got to blindly trust. You can't ever ask a question why. At least that's what it communicated to me. And so, I mean, we all have these statements like this, right? I mean, in the 90s, late 90s or so, it was, you know, when you can't trace his hand, trust his heart. It even became a song, right? We got all these statements that we make, these sentences that we'll just say, and there's nothing necessarily wrong with them, but they don't necessarily make us stronger either. We just say them not because we absolutely are convinced they're true, but because we know we're supposed to believe this, but in this moment, we're really having trouble believing that this is true. I think that's what Martha's doing right here. I mean, can you imagine somebody saying to Martha, you know, Jesus, if you'd have been here, he would not have died. And somebody looking at Martha, Martha, I know you're upset, but hey, calm down. I mean, after all, what would Jesus do? Martha would be like, I'll tell you what he'll do. He'll wait 2 days. That's what he'll do. He ain't coming on time. I think that's what she's doing here. And here's why I say that's what I think she's doing. Look at what happens later on in the story, down several verses later in verse 39. Jesus, he walks up to the tomb. He's about to raise Lazarus. He says, hey, take the stone away. And Martha, remember the one that just said, hey, if you'd have been here, it wouldn't have happened, but whatever you ask, God will give you. Hey, Jesus said, take the stone away. Martha says, Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he's been dead 4 days. Now, let me give you a little Easter gift right here. For all of you that maybe grew up reading the King James Version, this will be you'll remember this. All of you that did not grow up reading the King James Version of the Bible, this will be a gift for you today. Thank God that you didn't have to grow up reading that, because it's really confusing and a lot of these and thous and all this. Nothing wrong with it if you love it. I'm trying to be mean, but you know, there's a lot of statements in there that are hard to understand. Here's how the King James translates this. Lord, by this time, he stinketh. He stinketh. But do you see it? Do you see what she's doing? I mean, think about it. Here's what she says. Hey, God, Jesus, you know what I believe? God will give you whatever you ask. At the same time, it's been 4 days. I believe God will give you whatever you ask, but he's been dead 4 days. So let's be honest, this ain't happening. Well, Martha, do you believe it or not? I mean, will he or won't he? Is it he'll give me whatever I ask as long as it's not been 4 days? Or is it he'll give me whatever I ask? See, what I think Martha's doing right here, and I'm not trying to beat up Martha. I'm really not. I'm just saying what I think she's doing is she's saying what she knows she should believe, but she's really having trouble believing it. And the reason she's having trouble believing it is because when she looks at the past, and the hurt of her past is really clouding what she believes to be true about Jesus in the present. And you know what I think? I think sometimes the same thing's true of you. And the reason I think sometimes the same is true of you is because I know sometimes it's true of me. Sometimes what I know on paper to be true about Jesus finds it very difficult and just struggles to find its way into my heart, because there's something back there that is confusing and clouding what I know to be true about Jesus here. Because it's a legitimate question. Martha's response to all of this, though, look at what she says. Her response to all of this is to actually not talk about the past or the present. It's actually to look far in the future. Jesus, remember, says, hey, your brother will rise. And here's what she says to Jesus. I know that he'll rise again in the resurrection on the last day. You say you're going to raise my brother, Jesus? Okay, yeah, I believe in that future resurrection. I believe in one day you're going to set all things right. God's going to restore all this. One day, yes, that'll happen, but not this day. Not today. I mean, if you'd have been here, he wouldn't have died. But I know whatever you ask, God will give you. Don't know if I believe it or not, but I know I'm supposed to. What I am convinced of, though, and what I do believe is that one day out there, far, far, far in the future, yes, okay, you're going to make all this good and well, but where does that leave me today? You see, that's where her hope is. Her hope lies in the future. She believes that one day Jesus can, just not this day. And I think here's what tends to happen with a lot of us. That somewhere, there's something in the past that is holding us back from understanding why God. Why would you, God? How could you, God? And that thing, whatever it is, just confuses what we know to be true about Jesus and God today. And at best, our hope becomes that someday, way out there in the future, when I die and I go to heaven, God's going to make all things good and everything better, and it'll all be set right. Out there one day. Out, just not this day. And while that is certainly a part of Christianity, and it is an amazingly beautiful part of Christianity, that one day everything will be set right, the problem is that if that is the only hope we can see, it is so far out there in the future that it leaves us looking at today with very little belief that Jesus can do anything at all to change my present. And what Jesus is helping Martha see is that I am not just the resurrection in the last days. I'm the resurrection in the life today. This day. In verse 25, here's what he goes on to say. Jesus said to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And everyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." Martha, I'm your life. Martha, your brother will rise. And you know why he's going to rise? He's not just going to rise because I'm able to pull off a resurrection. He's going to rise because I am the resurrection and I am the life. And not just of some future event. I'm talking here now. I'm going to untangle your past and I'm going to deal with it. I'm going to help you understand it. I'm going to make sense of it. I'm going to uncomplicate it and unravel it and lay it before you so you see a much bigger, fuller picture than you ever did before. And I'm going to, as I untangle that past, I'm going to do it by reaching into the future and pulling your future hope of resurrection into the present and showing you that I am your hope today, yesterday, and forever. And by doing this, he's showing her that I'm the solution to the brokenness in your past. I am the answer to your present hollow religious cliches. And I am your future hope that is still 1,000 years away. I am the resurrection and the life. And then Jesus asks her a very simple question. He says to her, "Do you believe this? Do you believe?" To which she responds, "Yes, Lord, I believe." Now, this morning, we didn't gather together here to celebrate the resurrection of Lazarus, who would eventually die again anyway. We actually have gathered here to celebrate a much different resurrection, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, that shows us that death is dead, that sin is defeated, and that forevermore you and I can live in the light of that reality. That our past can be ironed out, it can be uncomplicated and untwisted and untangled, and Jesus can bring all the hurt and pain and the confusion of our past, bring it to the present, make sense of it by reaching into the future and bringing his resurrected life to you here, now, and today. That is what Jesus Christ being raised at Easter is all about. And so this morning, I want to end with a question, and a lot of times I'll end with a statement or a question that will kind of spur us to take what we've learned and what we've heard and what we believe and put it into action. Today, I want to back up and ask a question even before that. And the question I want to ask you is the same question that Jesus asked Martha. It's very simply, do you believe? Do you believe? Because Christianity begins with believing. It doesn't begin with having every answer to every question, and it certainly does not begin by discounting the pain of your past and the questions you have and the hurts that you've experienced and the things that make God not make sense to you right now, and not discounting it and not saying it doesn't matter at all. It's quite the opposite of that. But it does start by believing that Jesus is able to reach into the past and make sense of all of that and lead you to a future that you actually even begin to live here, now, and today. And over the next few weeks, as we walk through these other I am statements of Jesus, I am the good shepherd, I am the vine, I am the way, the truth, and the life, what we're going to continually find is that when Jesus invites us to follow him, he is inviting us into a type of life that can only be experienced by those who are in Christ, because to truly know Jesus changes everything. Easter is not just about what happened 2,000 years ago. Jesus did not just pull off a one-time resurrection. He is the resurrection, and he is the life. And so I want to close by speaking to two different groups that I know are in the room this morning, because if we were to take everybody in here and we were just to kind of divide us into two camps, everybody in this room would fall into one of two categories. Either those who believe this and do believe that Jesus is the resurrection and the life, and the other camp would be those who do not yet believe that. And if you're here this morning and you don't yet believe that, I want to ask you just to consider something for a minute. If you're hung up on your past, what I'm trying to tell you is that your sinfulness was not too much for Jesus. Your hurts are not too much for Jesus. Your questions are not too much for Jesus. Your objections are not too much for Jesus, because if they were too much for Jesus, he'd still be dead. But he's not still dead, he's alive. And because he's alive, what that means is that there is nothing you've done or could ever do or ever will do that is too much for him to overcome. He has forgiven. He has offered life. He is your forgiveness. He is your resurrection. He is your life. And if you still owed God anything, Jesus would still be dead. But because he is not, what that means is that every debt you ever owed God was paid, and it was paid in full. In fact, the last words Jesus spoke on this earth before he died was, "It is finished. It is finished. It's finished. It's finished." And my hope is that you would begin to let Jesus unveil to you and unravel for you the pain of your past, the questions of your past, the objections of your present, to show you who he is, and allow him to bring your future hope into the present. I want to invite you to trust in that. And if you're here this morning and you're in that other camp, you are already someone who does believe. You'd call yourself a Christian. If you're here this morning and you're a Christian, if ever there was a day to be grateful, and if ever there was a day to maybe even go a little old school and say a couple or three or four amens, it is today. All right, let me say that again. If ever there is a day, if you're a Christian, to rejoice and be grateful and maybe even go a little old school and throw out two or three or four amens, it would be today. Because he's not dead, he's alive. And our hope as Christians is not that years ago, 2,000 years ago, some great inspirational rabbi had some things to say that if you just listen and make them your own and live out some of what he said, it'd make your day and your life and your family and your future a little bit better. It's so much greater than that. It's a guy who came and lived as the Son of God, who became our resurrection in our life, who was crucified, buried, and 3 days later was raised and still is alive and offers you that same hope today and forever. And the reason that hope is yours is because you have believed that the tomb is empty. That is what we celebrate. And so I pray that as followers of Jesus, that we can embrace that and live in that, not just today, but every day. And if you're not yet that person who has believed, that today, maybe you could start. Doesn't mean you have every question answered. It doesn't mean you believe everything there is to believe. But Jesus even said, if your faith is as small as that of a mustard seed, give it to me. Let me show you what I'll do with it. Because I'll untangle your past and I'll bring the future hope of heaven and I'll bring it to the present and I'm going to change everything about everything because I'm the resurrection and the life. So I want to ask you to bow your heads and I want to pray with you and for you and over you. And I want to pray for both of those groups, both those that do not yet believe and those that do. So would you bow your heads and let's pray together. Father, I thank you for the hope that we have in Jesus, that it is not just the hope that 2,000 years ago somebody lived who had some good things to say, but God, your Son came in the form of man as our resurrection and our life to offer us everything we could not get on our own. God, and I pray that the words we learned and read about and heard today that he spoke to Martha all those years ago would resonate with us. That regardless of what it is in our past, it's keeping us from seeing what's true about you today. That God, you would uncomplicate and untangle our past and make sense of it in a way that we could see who you really are. And if we have friends here today that have not yet believed because there's some objection that they have or some question that is haunting them and there's some reason that they don't think they're good enough or they don't measure up, God, I pray that you would destroy all of those objections. You would do away with all of that and you would show them and convince them in this moment that your Son went to that cross for them and was raised for them, that you want them, and that you love them, and that you're for them. God, for those of us that have stepped into that already, that today would be more than just another Christian religious holiday. It would be a day that we pause to remember the reason for the hope that we have, and that is that your Son is not dead, but he is alive. And he is our resurrection and our life. And he brought the future hope of heaven into the present in such a way that does away and redeems all of our past and leads us to a glorious life today and forevermore. God, that our trust would be in him on this day. Thank you, God, that when Jesus went to that cross, the words he spoke were true. It is finished. And we celebrate that today in Jesus' name. Amen.